I'm John Duncan Clare, John D. Clare.
Your designation?
I'm currently Deputy Head Teacher in charge of Raising Achievement at Greenfield School in Newton Aycliffe in County Durham.
Thank you. Please can you tell me a little bit about yourself, your home background, parents and schooling, and if you can remember anything about the way in which you were taught history at school?
I come from a terribly privileged background, actually. I went as a fee-paying pupil to Bradford Grammar School, which in those days was a direct grant school, but I didn't get the scholarship. I had to pay to go, and from there on to Oxford University. So I have had the most privileged background educationally. The thing I always tell the children about my education, my history education, was that for an entire year I was taught by a teacher who was an alcoholic, and his way of teaching us was that he would sit us down, we would give out the textbooks, and we would divide our page into three columns: who did it, what he did, when he did it. And we would then spend the rest of the hour, 2 hours a week, just noting the textbook in these three columns, never marked. Actually an appalling standard of teaching, and destined to put one off.
Can you remember how you felt though when you were in those lessons?
Oh, you felt aggrieved. But in those days, you didn't have any say. There was no pupil voice in those days. You just did as you were told, didn't you?
But it didn't put you off history.
I got into history by sheer fluke, really. Coming up Bradford Grammar, you were expected to do the classics, ancient history, Latin and Greek. And children of any ability didn't do anything other than those. I wasn't particularly able within the school, but I was in the top stream. But I decided I wanted to do what were called modern studies in those days, which was geography, history and economics. And there was all hell about this. There was so much trouble because somebody in the top stream, in the classics stream, wanted to break out and do these subjects at A level. And I did the three subjects, and history was the hardest of all. That was the one I didn't do. I was a year ahead of myself, and so they deemed that really I was too immature to go to university, so I better stick around for another year. So I took the A levels again at S level, and I got A stars at geography and economics, and an A at history. And on the grounds that that was the one subject I hadn't yet conquered, I went to university to do history. It was sheer fluke and chance that I ended up at Oxford studying history.
So what made you decide to become a history teacher?
Mr. Thompson. Mr. Thompson was the geography teacher. He talks like this, and he was very, very exciting. And he really did make geography fun. And in those days, I was an ardent geographer, sort of. And I still get excited about drumlins. And Mr. Thompson made life so exciting that I just, at that point, I decided I wanted to make children's pupils' lives as exciting for them as Mr. Thompson had made the study of geography for me. So at that moment I wanted to become a teacher. I am a born teacher. I'm forever telling people how things are and how things ought to be and what they ought to be believing and did they know this, and but from Mr. Thompson came the desire to make it exciting and fun.
Lovely. So how did you learn to teach history? Did you go to teacher training college?
I went to I followed a girl to Van Mildert in Durham for my PGCE, but when I asked her out, she said no, so that was a bit of a wasted change of location. So maybe that's why maybe get on with my studies a bit better. And I studied under a guy called Mel French, how to teach history, and God and Betho. Sort of, I fell out with God somewhat. Now, God became a huge friend in later life, but sort of we fell out over dictated notes. Because he was very hostile to dictated notes, and he once caught me in a lesson dictating some notes, more of which later. I had no choice. It was so unfair. Was that Mel French was obsessed even in those days with the fact that what's the point of history? History is dying. We were dealing even in those days with the fact that history was dying in the classroom, and children didn't give it its proper importance. They didn't reckon history, and how could we upgrade the subject? Now, this is in the 70s, 1974, we're talking about this. And I learned that from him. And the idea of a graded worksheet as well, I remember that we had to do our worksheets so that we started off with the easy questions, but they got harder and harder as they went along. Then you were thrown into the classroom and left to cope.
So did they come and observe you in the classroom?
We did have some observations, yes, and I generally staggered through. It was very different being a student to being a teacher as well, I found. I must say thank you publicly to 9X, who was the first history class I ever taught. 9X and 9P, who made my life an absolute misery for my first year of teaching. And of course, I say now to many young teachers, those are the classes that teach you the trade. It's the classes you can, who don't sit quiet, who do kick against the pricks. They're the ones who teach you how to teach. And it was 9X and 9P that taught me how a young teacher teaches nowadays. I just do not know how they break into the room. Remember when I started teaching, you could clatter them. How on earth they do it? They must be so intensely skilled. I think I learnt the job much more on the job in those days, basically through a process of trial and error, didn't you?
But how long did it take you to feel confident in the classroom?
I don't know whether I still feel confident in the classroom. I think my view of teaching is that it is a relationship between teachers and pupils. And one of the joys of being a teacher is that you never learn how to do it. You never know what you're going to meet in that classroom when you go into the classroom. You never know how this child is going to cut up. There's always some new problem that you have to meet, and I'm still going into the classroom now, and I'm still failing 30, 40 years after I first went into the classroom. I'm still failing to meet the needs of the children, having to go away and say, well, where did that go wrong, and go back and try again. The other thing is that I've always been confident. Now, you see, the thing is that I come up through Sunday school teaching, Pathfinder camps, and the difference between somebody that had that kind of background and somebody perhaps who just went to school and then went to teacher training college is that they were there voluntarily. You know, when we went down on the beach and we sort of got our guitars out and started playing, we had to attract the children, and then we had to hold them by making it fun. And so there's very much more this kind of feeling that it is my job to make the children want to come to me as a teacher and to sell the subject to them, to make it interesting. I've always had the knowledge that I could get children excited and get the fun side. So in a way, I've always been confident, but in another way, I've never felt I could do the job properly.
Thinking back to those early days in the classroom, what kind of history were you teaching, and which aspects did you enjoy or not enjoy?
The first day I rolled in to Woodham, the most wonderful man called Colin Rutherford, who was the head of department there, gave me a set of 7 exercise books. Now, this is GCE. But he gave me a set of 7 exercise books and he said, there, that's what you've got to get into your children's exercise books. And the process of teaching GCSE in those days was making sure that my children had exactly the same notes as his children had, and his children had last year, and next year I had the same job of getting those same notes into the pupils' books. It sort of, over the years, you accumulated sort of groups of exercise books stuck together with sellotape, which if a child was absent, you would say, take that home and copy up, and they would copy them up. And that was because, I think this is from later on, this question, but the thing is that this was because in those days, the same questions came up again and again at GCSE. So history at GCSE...
You mean O-level?
Sorry, at O-level, yes. History at O-level was simply a memory exercise. And you had all the answers in your exercise books, because I'd made sure you'd copied it out, and you went home and learned it, and then simply regurgitated it on the paper. And seeing as the same questions came up every year, it was fairly much easy to sort of perm any 3 from 20. And that's how you got your GCSEs.
So how did you react to that as a young teacher?
We never questioned it. You just did as you were told, didn't you? And I tried to make it as fun as possible. And the other thing is succeeded. And sort of teaching in those days was full of tricks, like ladders, sort of a game where you sort of answered a question. If you got the question wrong, you moved down. If you got it right, you moved up. Memory games. You would teach a set content, an accepted content, a corpus. You would teach that in as interesting a way as you could find. And in a way, the games you were playing were transferable, because you could have used them to teach RE and geography, and in fact I did. You had these little games and tricks that you played, the children loved them, and then they went away and learnt it, and just sort of then copied that from as much as memory as possible for their exams.
So were there boring bits of the lessons where they had to copy down notes as well?
Lots of dictation, yes. Lots of dictation.
But interspersed with fun games?
Yeah. And presenting the subject is in as fun a way as you possibly can.
You wouldn't use those memory games today? Or
I do,
you?
Yes.
I still
play ladders, yes.
What syllabuses were you actually teaching throughout the school before the national curriculum came in?
One of the big problems with, not only the fact that really you weren't teaching anything that resembled proper history to these children. The other problem with the which must have come up to the other people you've been talking about, was that we started with the Saxons and Vikings in year 7, what we called the first year, and we basically staggered on to Tudors and Stuarts-ish by the end of year 9, what we called the third year. And we were, I mean, some schools didn't get past King John. I mean, so when they did all those surveys on which they sort of based the necessity for a national curriculum, they found some schools that didn't get past the Plantagenets. And there was this dreadful mess of children coming from different schools, not knowing anything about any history before the Tudors. And of course, many children then would drop history in year, was year 4 in those days, is year 10 now. They'd drop history knowing nothing of history after the Fire of London. And this was the justification for the national curriculum, and in fact it was absolutely correct that should be so. I mean, it was wrong.
So in the lower school you were going up to Tudors, and what did you do for O level?
We did I can't remember. We started with the Glorious Revolution and we made our way up to the middle of the 19th century, Peel and all that. That was it.
And that was political history.
It was. We did spend a little while on the Agricultural Revolution and the Industrial Revolution, but it was a minor part. The main thing was the political things. I remember many happy lessons on the seven reasons Walpole came to power, and the nine reasons Walpole stayed in power, and the eight reasons Walpole fell from power. Go home and learn those. We're having a test on it tomorrow.
Well, did you do any CSE?
Now that was fun. pardon me. We did Mode 3 CSE, which was absolutely marvellous. You made up your own course. You made up your own exam. I had so much fun making exams, which trying to make get up exams that the children might actually be able to answer. Of course, you could study exactly what you want. And we had a very local history course. And it was aimed absolutely at the least able pupils. So,
did you develop that course in a team of teachers, or was it something you did on your own?
It had been developed by Colin Rutherford, and he passed on the materials to me as head of department, but I added to them. You were expected, and I enjoyed creating my own materials. And of course, that is part of the answer to the question that you're going to ask later on about how I came to be writing textbooks. You went away and you would sort of immerse yourself in the local archives looking for stuff on this and that to sort of teach lessons on it.
And was it mainly on the social and economic history of
yes.
the surrounding area, the Durham Coalfield? That
hugely, thing? Yes. It's wonderful things like Colin had these tapes, which I got, which I still possess, and which I recently got transcribed of miners talking about the coming of the nationalisation. These rough voiced miners talking and the clock ticking in the background, lovely. And you'd sit down and listen to, of course, in those days, listening to a tape was as exciting as watching a singing and dancing multimedia computer presentation nowadays. I mean, you could sort of put on a tape recorder and the children would sit transfixed for hours. They didn't even need to make notes. They would, it was very, very exciting, and modern teaching was that.
Were you using television as well at that time?
No, not in those days.
This is 70s, yes.
Yeah, early 70s, mid 70s. I can't remember when we started using television. I don't really remember. I do remember something which is very, very amusing, and I tell my own children now when we watch films and things like that, that in my own personal education at Bradford Grammar, sort of in the 1960s, I only ever saw one film educationally, and they brought in a film to show to us. God knows what it was about, and there was a lot of fuss as they set it up with the old kind of reel-to-reel things, and we got so overexcited that after 5 minutes they turned it off and said we were not fit to listen to this, we were misbehaving too much and they weren't going to show it to us. And that was it. That was the end of that. Of course, I used to use the old reel-to-reel movies. You use those quite a lot. It was quite a skill to be able to thread them through. I remember being invited into the classroom of the teacher next door, who was showing one of these reel-to-reel movies, and he said, "John, there seems to be something wrong with this." And it managed to thread it through the machine, but it forgot to attach it onto the wind-on spool at the back. So it was just sort of pouring out of the back of the machine, and he'd been sort of having children collecting it in their hands as it came through. And by the time it had reached four children with their arms full of movie reel, sort of, he decided to send for me to ask what was going wrong. So, and I became quite a famous at my school because I knew how to set up. I forget even what were those things called with the two little windy things, and it had a kind of a reel of pictures on a roll.
A radio vision.
There was no sound. It was just a film strip, and sort of what you did is you had this kind of box thing with these two windy things, and you fixed it in, but it had to be upside down but right way around, and then you fixed it on and reeled it through, and I was the bright young man in the school, who knew how to set this up. So I ended up being called up to my lessons all over the school for all these aged teachers. Set this up for me, John. Oh yes, I said, it's very easy, back to front and right way around.
Actually, the film strips sometimes were produced together with radio programmes.
Yes, you had these things, and you set the tape recorder going, and you turned it on at the ting. It was so much fun. And
things have changed a lot, haven't they? So how did your ideas about teaching history develop during the 70s and 80s?
Which question are we on?
Number 5. What was influencing you in developing your teaching?
I think we're jumping to question 8 here. I mean, basically, happened was, at this point, I have to mention the name of Dennis Schemmelt. And I went as a fairly young teacher to hear Dennis Schemmelt speak about school's history project. You know, when I was 14, I went to a Billy Graham rally and became a Christian there, went forward. But I can't remember anything that Billy Graham said, apart from the fact that he kept banging the lectern with his Bible and shouting, "Vanity of vanity," says the preacher, "all is vanity." But it did affect the whole of the rest of my life. I have to say that maybe I need to be ashamed of the fact that Dennis Schemmelt had the same effect on me. I can't remember a damn thing that the man said, but it was like a Damascus Road experience listening to him talk. It was an epiphany for me because suddenly he started... Basically, I realised that I had been up through a O-level, A-level, and I'd studied history at Oxford, and I didn't have a clue about history, about the study of history. I didn't know what I was talking about. I couldn't tell you how to study a source. I didn't know. What did you look for when you studied a source? I mean, I'd used them, obviously. But in those days, what you used to do is you used your sources almost as part of an ongoing narrative. You merely produced them as sort of little bits of evidence, as hats out of the back, completely out of context. And the concept of history being based on sources was a radical exciting idea for me. And then the idea that we might give sources to children and that they may study them and do them for themselves. And how do you teach them how to do this? And I was just... Well, my life as a history teacher was changed by Dennis Schemmelt. I went home a different man. I suspect Dennis might be absolutely horrified by the way that my history's developed since, but he set me down a road, and I just went away and got on with it then. And like Billy Graham, I only remember one thing he said, and somebody said to him, "How can you put these sources before children when they are so difficult to understand and to read?" And he said, "Bowdlerise," he said. I didn't even know what bowdlerising was. I mean, I got the gist of what it meant from the context, but that was the only bit I remember, that he just said, "Bowdlerise, for God's sake." It was fabulous. And so I then began to change. I did not abandon some of the excited... Children love stories. They just love... I can sit down a set of the naughtiest year 9 pupils and least able, you know, in pupils, because that's where I've specialised for the last decade, sort of, and I can talk to them for an hour about the murder of Franz Ferdinand at Sarajevo, and I won't pause for breath, and they will not, not one of them will glance sideways. I can keep them absolutely thrilled. The story side of history is, I think, still the big power over children. But I went away and I began to understand that what we need to do as history teachers is to give them the bricks and let them begin to try and work and build their own history out of this. And this is where it becomes really quite exciting, because what, and I think it relates to an awful lot what goes on in the later questions, what we did until the school's history project was, we had decided what the history of this country was. We knew as history teachers, and it was written down in Reed Brett there, and we saw our job as history teachers as being merely to convey this accepted body of doctrine to the children so that they may learn it and then pass it on in their turn. And sort of, and what School's History Project made me realise was, in fact, that history is, that's not what teaching history is about at all. Teaching history is about teaching people how to look at the things of the past and make sense of them, and make your own sense of them, and come up with your own ideas about it. And at the risk of being political, sort of all those important people, many of them are very clear what they want history to do, but that's what they want it to do. They want history to do something, and the last thing they want history to do is to, for children to be coming out with ideas different to the ones that they see history as a tool to perpetuate some kind of ideology that they think that is necessary to perpetuate. And sort of my view of history is it became that what you do is you lay the tools out on the table and then you get the children to sort of investigate them.
But do you think that when you as a teacher were transmitting this accepted narrative, you were then the pawn of some, political philosophy or political aim to imbue children with a particular viewpoint about their past?
I don't think we thought about it in those days. I mean, I must have been terribly naive, because I'd read Mao's Little Red Book, but I just went into the classroom and I got my six exercise books. And what we were teaching, Reed Brett was written in 1933, and sort of we were still using that as a textbook in the classroom, and we were sort of, I always remember being tremendously amused with the children because it said that Rodney fell in with the French off Cape Breton, and it always amused us terribly that this admiral had fallen in, and sort of, and when I did my early training, I used to get this most terribly imperialistic, nationalistic, racist little passage from Reed Brett that we were just churning out. And Unstead, bless him, he was wonderful and exciting, but we were teaching them that how brave Clive had been, but his native soldiers had said, "You English men, you need more sustenance than we Indians. You can eat the rice, and we will just eat the rice water." And sort of, it's dreadful racist twaddle. And you were reading it, and you never actually thought about it. And I'm not saying that I suddenly became very left-wing overnight. It was just that I saw that the children had to be able, my job as a history teacher was to present them with the tools and then allow them to actually weigh them and think about them and come up with their own theories of what were going on. in history, and I don't think I've changed that one little bit of my most recent series. Does exactly the same thing, and what it does is it asks a question, it studies the historical background, and then you end up with the two sides and the debate, and you make up your own mind.
But it's within a range of historically valid statements.
Absolutely, correctly. And the other thing, you don't let you have to understand that you're dealing with children here, and you've not got to let them go galloping down morally indecent pathways. You've got a duty as a teacher to guide them during through this process. But nevertheless, that's what's at heart. Just moving on slightly. Mm. When I wrote, I mean, the question says, what in your view really switches on children learning to history? And when I wrote this, which I do believe, perhaps incorrectly, but
the age of expansion.
Yeah, well, it's the options in history series. I do think it was the first series that came with a full set of printed lesson notes and materials. I do think that was the first.
What year was that?
Early to mid 90s, but I mean, it may not be, but it came with an introduction here, and sort of what at this point my this is sort of mid 90s, what at this point my principle was, and I was trying to get people to do, was to make every lesson different. That was the idea, that if you had a lesson where that you were doing a lot of copying and writing and close exercises last lesson, let's do a drama and do some moving around the classroom this lesson, and then if you did the drama, sort of let's watch some kind of visual materials, and now let's go back to some written work and some written sources, and now let's look at some visual sources. Try and make every lesson different to the last one. Keep the children excited and interested by ringing the changes. Now, I do. Basically, when I was just thinking about this question here before we started the interview, I have changed that since I got into special needs teaching, and when I do training sessions for special needs teachers, I always say that special needs teaching is exactly the opposite of what you would expect. Sort of with average-abled and more-able children, you want to excite and stimulate. Sort of with special needs children, that's the last thing you want to do. And sort of actually, the best way to teach them is to make it as dull as ditch water. And sort of if you need to bring a class of average able children to attention, sort of you might choose to raise your voice and get a bit cross. That is exactly the wrong way with special needs children, the wrong approach. I often say that the teaching of special needs children is arse uppers. And sort of what the reason is for this is because your brain is not something that takes in information. There's so much sensory information exploding into your brain at all time that there's no problem with information going into your brain. What makes a clever brain is that the brain is an organ to sift information, to exclude and reject information by deciding what's important. And so whereas with average and more able children, there's nothing wrong with exciting them because that provokes them to want to learn more. Sort of as soon as you start exciting special needs children, then their brain stops that process of sifting, and they just goes in and they lose control of themselves. and sort of you have to, and special needs teaching is all about providing a calm and quiet environment and a very, very focused and honed and limited corpus of material, which is what you want them to learn.
You mean lots of structure?
Absolutely, yes. And sort of very limited amounts of information and single messages as well. In fact, whereas the first half of my career was all about getting the children overexcited, if truth be told, sort of the second half of my career has been all about being as calm as a glassy pond and sort of trying to simplify it to its absolute basic structures.
Because you specialise in teaching special needs pupils.
Within the states, you know, within the mainstream sector, I haven't gone into special education.
No.
Yes, within the mainstream sector for the past decade, and longer, if truth be told, but for the last 15 years.
There's a sort of suspicion that old-fashioned teaching methods, as you described at the start of your career, were actually more suited to special needs children than to the able.
For the reasons that I say, funnily enough, yes.
Although the quantity of material would be quite daunting, I suppose.
When you think back to some of those special needs classes in the early days, you would just give them a MOS textbook, a Peter Marks textbook, and they would just spend hours doing close exercises of it was really appalling teaching. I wouldn't teach in that way now. There's no excuse for poor teaching of special needs on the grounds that, well, old fashioned is the best. And I think all this modern stuff about visual and auditory and kinesthetic and things like that, that is absolutely critical for special needs children. Sharing another prejudice with you, I always say that any fool can teach clever children, but it takes a real teacher to help a child over a learning barrier, and that's what you're doing. Yes, in the last for the last 15 years, it's been discovered that I can make Wrigley children sit still. So my teaching is a diet of naughty classes and special needs classes, whom I love. I wouldn't do anything else.
So thinking back to that period of the sudden realisation that you wanted to teach history in a different way, how did you proceed? Did you immediately change the way you were doing things, or was it a gradual change?
Well, you couldn't change immediately, and as I said, I kept a lot of the good bits from the one of the things, just sharing a prejudice with you now, one of the things I get cross about with the government is that the number of times they change things, and when somebody says, here is a set of things, your national curriculum, we want you to teach this, you think, oh, I'll teach that, and you go through and you teach it, and I'm quite a good teacher. But at the end of the year, I look back over the 40 weeks, and that's all you've got. 80 lessons at most. I look back over the 80 lessons. And I'm quite pleased if 50 or 60 of them went well. And I can tell you there'll be 20 or 30 of them on, you know, on the cutting room floor, not fit to teach again. So what you do is you keep the ones that worked well, and even sort of you do the other 20 again. And sort of, but then you have other things to do, because then what you've got to do is you've got to go and make sure that the homework is fit and appropriate, and you've got to devise homework, and all this is preparation time. The other thing you need to do is you need to understand that there's more able children and less able children. You can't just teach to the middle. You have to sort of differentiate all these lessons. And then there's other people coming along saying, right, you know, have you fitted this into the school's art specialism? Oh no, I'm going to get a bit of this. What's this thing we have to do now about economics? We have to fit them for the future economically. Oh, golly, it's got it. And you're building this, and over time, you build up a corpus of lessons which really work. And the thing about this was that it wasn't written in sort of 6 months because somebody had brought out a new curriculum. What it was it was the result of 20 years of teaching, and I merely wrote down what I'd been teaching for the, and built up over the last 20 years. It represented the sort of the end result of 20 years of refining lessons. Sort of now, the changing syllabus is every 2 or 3 years. People are sitting down and writing textbooks. The first textbook I ever wrote took 4 years from sort of writing it to finishing it. And it was a tremendously leisurely and gentlemanly thing at Macmillan's. But sort of the now, sort of people will ring you up and say, we have a GCSE textbook, 260 pages. I went and needed August, and sort of and you say, well, that's a high. Well, you've got the holidays, and you sit down and you write these things at a frenetic pace. What's more, without copy editors, as you used to have to checking you and sort of and it's a miracle that the textbooks are of the quality they are, quite frankly, and the. And there's none of this slowly building up a corpus of really good lessons, because as soon as you, before you've even finished one set, somebody says, oh, we're going to all change a new syllabus and move on again. That is one of my complaints about the way things have gone.
Has it affected the quality of textbooks that are produced? Isn't they more formulaic than they used to be?
I think they're better than they ever used to be. I think there were some appalling textbooks, weren't there? I think we're more focused about what we want to happen in a textbook, what we want the textbook to do.
Well, what are your priorities as a textbook author?
Clarity, I think. Not patronising the learner, and being absolutely clear in the language, and also giving the teacher a tool whereby I think it's very important that when a teacher sits down with the textbook and says turn to page 34 and you look at a double page spread there, that there is enough to keep the children interested and active for the hour of his lesson.
So a double-page spread is supposed to be an hour's work?
Well, no, not necessarily, because sometimes you might take a four-page for an hour. But sort of whatever you designate as being, I think there needs to be enough there in terms of reading and writing and ideas and activities for whatever you designate as a lesson. The teacher needs to know this will keep them going nicely for an hour. And they at the end of it, they'll have learnt something. It'll move them on down a road of learning towards some end which I have actually set in my textbook. Yes.
So what actually brought you into the textbook writing?
Well, it goes back to what I was talking to you earlier about, where I said I was developing my own materials for the Mode 3, and I was also developing my own materials for the school's history project and writing your own textbooks and finding your own sources and things. And
so at Woodham, you moved over to school's history project, did you?
No, this was I'd gone to Greenfield at this time. I spent 4 years at Woodham, 75 to 79. And in 79, I went to Greenfield, and I've been there ever since.
So at Greenfield, you brought in the school's history
project? Yes, I did, yes. I can remember a smashing interview with the head teacher where I went and said, I want to change syllabuses. And he said, well, Mr. Lyle, why? And so I explained. This is complete unknown, but this is where history ought to be going. And the head teacher was able to say, well, if you think that this is where history ought to be going, you take it in that direction, Mr. Clare. Wouldn't happen nowadays. The head teacher would be asking, what will be the points, Scar, at the end of it? What points will this give the school? Not in those days, so I was able to do it on philosophical grounds. We moved up to school history, and I was doing materials, and I just read some of these books which were supposed to be sort of more kind of school history project-ish. Because remember, you had your school history project, but it was really only medicine through time and American West at those days. And what there were sort of other people trying to do the same kind of thing and failing spectacularly in other areas. And there was, and I thought I could do better than this. And there was a live series going called History in Depth Macmillan, run by Martin Dickinson and John Jones. And I can remember writing to Martin Dickinson and saying, I think I got a textbook in me and I could offer you these subjects. How would I go about getting a crack at this? And he wrote back and he said, send me a manuscript on the agricultural revolution and we'll see where we go from there. And I sent him a manuscript on the agricultural revolution and he passed me over to John Jones, who actually did some teaching of how to write a textbook. And she and then he passed me on to a copy editor who's called Jilly Abrahams, who every textbook writer ought to have to work with, and she taught me the trade of writing textbooks. Oh, long telephone calls in those days.
So were you including exercises for the pupils in the books at that time?
Yes.
As well as source material?
Yes, definitely.
So that was a real contrast with earlier textbooks.
It was. Which sort of, it wasn't just content or content with some sources. And I can remember believing very strongly in those days that what you had to do was that you had to set questions on the sources. Sort of, it wasn't, you were actually asking the children to consider the sources and evaluate the sources and how what they were worth as sources. And not just sort of use them as another text with some factual extraction.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of I did some work with Gordon Batho and the HA about hierarchies of source work, trying to build hierarchies of source work. And I did a sabbatical for the HA, for the Young Historian Scheme, and out of that came so a whole set of not just materials, because quite frankly no sooner had I finished it than the historical than the national curriculum swept in and invalidated the lot, but the it was all about you know, how you use sources and what are the higher skills in source work and what are the lower skills and how should we rank these skills, and that was a lot of fun.
Do you think that your style of approaching the task of textbook writing has changed over time? You've now been writing them for 20 years?
Yeah, and I would say not really. When I wrote Options in History, I was quite pleased because everybody was very nice about it. And particularly they said that it was simply written. And I was very pleased with myself about the fact that ordinary children could read this script. And I met a woman from a special needs school, and I made a fool of myself with that lady because I was talking about, yes, we're writing for the less able children so they could read it. And it became clear that her children couldn't read my books, but she used them because she felt that they needed to use proper materials, and I realised that there were large numbers of children there who just could not read the text, so I started getting interested in dyslexia. I took a further qualification in it, a diploma in it. I became a BDA approved teacher, and I put an awful lot of work into developing text. And when I wrote the Foundation series, I can't remember the name of the series, but it was the Foundation series for Hodder, their Hodder History, I think it was called. It was like a Ladybird book, and what it did was it started off with a very tiny corpus of 400 words with the Romans, and then it built up the words through the, as you worked through the books, built up the words, and every time you met a new word, it said these are the new words, and it told you it, and it was as much a reading scheme as a set of textbooks. And I worked very hard on producing books that children can use. As soon as it goes below 95%, immediate recognition, basically you might as well just throw the textbook as well. Once a child is having to stop and think about 5 words in 100, then the child, the book is too hard for the child to read. And so I've really got myself a bit kind of typecast as this kind of foundation writer, this child who can write, this teacher who can write for the less able child, and sort of and that's where I've made my mark as a writer ever since. What happened recently, the most strange thing, because I stopped teaching history about 4 years ago. We got a very bright student, we got a chance to keep him, but there was no history teaching for him. We were short of an English teacher, so I moved over to teaching English, and for the last five years I've been teaching special needs English, not history. And sort of they drafted me in recently to help write an English textbook as well, which is the craziest thing, because I know nothing about teaching English, but it's on this ability to express things in a way that less able pupils can understand them that I've built my textbook career for the last decade.
Do you think that history textbooks have a role actually in influencing the curriculum?
No, it's the other way around. I think, and particularly recently, mm-hmm. I think that if you talk to any publishers, they're just running like crazy people after the latest government scheme, the latest syllabus. They're desperately trying to get writers to write them before the schemes are finalised. They're then sending the finalised schemes to the writers, who are desperately rewriting the relevant chunks. So I'm sure there's chaos going on.
But what about teachers' classroom practice? Do they actually change the way teachers teach?
I've always worked on the principle that there's a number of different kinds of teachers. There are teachers like me. I've never really used textbooks. I've always gone and done my own thing. And what you do is you send off for a whole raft of inspection copies, and then you just photocopy the bits you want. You pinch this from here and that from there, and you put them together into your lesson. I think that's the correct way to do it, but we all go desperately bankrupt very quickly if every teacher did that. And sort of all over the country there are these tremendously creative teachers doing this, building their own lessons. And that's what they should do, because it should be built for their individual classes, with their individual classes in mind. But then you get a whole load of teachers who, for reasons of lack of confidence or perhaps lack of training, or perhaps like me, they've moved subjects. They like the security of a textbook, and a textbook is a security for them. And I think there are large numbers of teachers who will, this is out of date now, but I'm still producing the modern equivalents to accompany these series. And what they do is they say, I've got to teach, what shall I teach? Well, the next lesson in the book is, and here are the teaching ideas, and I think that's a good one, that'll work with my children. And they use these materials, and so they go through the textbooks with the children.
So it's more a case of there's a textbook to suit each style of teacher, rather than the textbook actually changing teachers' way of doing things. Or do you think people have been influenced by your books to change the way they do things?
Oh, definitely the latter. I mean, people write to me all the time and say, you know, that book changed my life, and things like that. I think there's a process by which the initial choice, which remember is not often made by the actual teacher who just ploughs through the textbook, it's made by their head of department for them. But I think there is a process by which somebody will sit down and look at styles, and they will say, we like John Clare's style, we like Ben Walsh's style. Sort of, you know, the teachers develop tremendous loyalties. I mean, it's quite touching in a way. They are loyal to a writer, and we always like what Ben Walsh does, and they stick with him. But once they've made that choice, I think there's a whole group of teachers who then will just do as they're told. And part of their teaching skills are in choosing the bits of the lesson that you've suggested and trying this game. And this works really well. I tried that and it worked really well. I'm very excited, thank you very much. I shall use it again.
And that's the satisfaction, I suppose, of writing books.
There's a lovely bit, I thought about this, there's a lovely bit in Matilda where he says, where Matilda's bringing the books home from the library, and it talks about all those authors who've sent their book out into the world like ships on the waves. And sort of, I think, I hope you don't think me tremendously, dreadful, really, isn't it? Give myself airs. But there's this element of it that you there is this kind of missionary kind of element. But I think there's much more to it than that. I think the first thing about the personal motivation of doing it is that I've always had this kind of thing. Well, this is what I do. It works. You're welcome. You're welcome to it. Help yourself. If it doesn't work for you, throw it in the bin. I don't think there's that. And the other thing that you have to understand about writing textbooks, and we're talking much more about writing textbooks than about teaching history, I think, but sort of the other thing about writing textbooks is that it is a gloriously creative experience. And to sit down and decide what you want to say and to do the research and then to build the activities and then at the end of it, it is, and I'd regard it for all the worse you may think of it, but it is like painting a picture. It's as creative as an actor's doing a sculpture, and sort of that is my painting. That is what I created, and I used words, not paints. But nevertheless, to have been given the opportunity since 1986 was when I started. To do this again and again and again and again, and to get money for doing so, has been so much. It's been a real privilege. It's been one of the best bits of doing the job.
Can I just ask you about this comment you made about teachers creating from bits and pieces of different textbooks their own resources? Because it's a phenomenon that seems to date from the 1970s.
Mm.
Why do you think that became the trend? What was the real reason why teachers suddenly became more creative in their use of resources at that time? Because as you said, early on in your career, you just used the standard textbook with new notes.
It was, I cannot remember what the letters were, and I've been racking my brains, but there was, at the end of the 70s and in the early 80s, there was a whole thing came in about what we had to teach and how we had to teach, and it had four letters. It wasn't GNVQ. My friend Malcolm McGregor, I got the post of inset coordinator, and he was teacher in charge of, and then these four letters, and I still haven't been able to remember them. But the whole thing was about, it was transferable skills were the idea. And it came from employers.
TVEI.
That's right! You got it!
Yes.
Yes, it is! And TVEI, and it was all part of the same thing. And it was all about transferable skills. And employers were saying, we're getting lots of people who are, you know, able to churn out sort of these essays on the seven reasons Walpole came to power. But sort of when we say sit down and develop something with a team of people, they have no teamwork skills, they have no initiative skills, they can't think for themselves. What we want is these transferable skills. And there's a whole raft of them. And we were sort of encouraged to teach. And we sort of, everybody was sort of... it was part of a long process by which people have come to us and said, you're doing your job improperly, we know how to do it better. And sort of, and my view of history is that, and teaching history is that you can teach how you make up your mind, we can deliver that, you know, just tell us what we need. And, but sort of what we did was we changed all our classrooms. I went for a double horseshoe. It was so we could interact and work in groups and discuss as a whole group. And it was all investigative. I can remember being inspected by an Ofsted inspector. I talked and gave them something and said, now get on talking with that. And sort of they all sat there. And I said to the Ofsted inspector, I said, I'm going to leave the room and can you leave too, please? Because our presence in the classroom is inhibiting the children while they work. We're going to go out and stand in the corridor for 5 minutes. And when we come back, they'll all have talked about this. They won't be inhibited by our presence. So me and the Ofsted inspector went and stood in the corridor for 5 minutes. And we went back in and they'd all got all the notes. And we had these rip-roaring... and he was delighted with it. I mean, he thought it was a great lesson. I think he would have got into trouble nowadays. And it was all part of this, all part of what they wanted us to develop. They wanted us, I mean, I used to take children up the dale in groups of 13. We would find some unsuspecting archaeological lead mining site, and I would say, investigate, and they would rip it apart and pull grass up and go digging and find rails, and then we'd all come home and we'd put together our picture of what we'd thought the site had been, and we were covered with mud. I mean, a sort of, how somebody didn't die, I don't know. And the we were just sort of lucky that there wasn't a disaster. And it was all about teaching in that way. And it was for the time. And then, of course, the national curriculum came in and you tried to keep it going as long as you want. But then under the steady drip, drip of other initiatives, slowly. Can you remember all that thing where a little while later it came in? You're not the manager of the classroom, you're the teacher and you have to teach them. And there was all this kind of thing that unless you were actually telling the children what was and what wasn't, then you were going to get, you got low scores on the observations. And then of course it goes on, and nowadays we're looking at learning is what's the but nevertheless the teacher has to be proactive within the, but the children have to learn, and it's all based on the children, and you have all these things that they're trying to put the emphasis on. But that was why things changed.
Thank you, it was really interesting. Did GCSE have any impact on your approach to things?
No, because we were already doing a school's history project. All GCSE did was basically regularised it across the Key Stage 4 curriculum. I do want to say something about this, because there was an awful lot of trouble in those 80s between skills versus content. And we would have meetings of teachers where we would have... huge public rows about whether it was skills or content, and you took your side, as it were. And it always struck me as being very false, because you couldn't exercise skills without knowing some content. And really, you shouldn't be learning content without exercising at least basic skills. I always felt that it was much more, that struggle was much more a struggle between right and left, and and going back to what I was saying earlier about what we were trying to teach when we taught history.
Some people have suggested that GCSE stripped the thinking skills back to a level which deprived it of its essential purpose, because the source work became very formulaic and the attempt to assess things like empathy were artificial.
I'm going to talk about empathy under question 10. One of the things is that sort of during the when they were bringing in the national curriculum, I got involved in the Historical Association watchdog committee quite enthusiastically, and we held lots of meetings up here. It was one of the most productive time in teacher training. Teachers, history teachers, really got together and talked meaningfully about what they wanted. It was smashing, and the Historical Association was at the forefront in that, and I can remember organising huge conference after conference up here.
So you're talking about 1990, around the time when they were developing it, or later?
Wasn't it
1989 to 91?
Was it as late as that, the national curriculum?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, when it was.
Yeah.
Whenever it was. And one of the casualties of that process was the idea of empathy. And the Historical Association came out quite strongly against empathy, and it always broke my heart, because by that time I decided that actually that's what history was, empathy. Maybe I defined it differently, but I thought I'd come to the conclusion that being a historian was about trying to get into the mind and ways of the people that you were studying. That's what I called empathy. And the deeper you could get into the mind, the more successful you'd been as a historian. And this was poo-pooed. And we lost empathy. I did mourn the loss of Mode 3 CSE. I thought that was desperate. I do have very strong feelings about the exam setup in history, which I've addressed in later questions.
Right. So, moving on to the national curriculum, you were very involved in the discussions about it. At the time, did you feel hostile, or did you feel welcoming? Did you think it would correct some of the problems from earlier?
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. I mean, it was utterly wrong that people didn't go past the Armada. It did mean that we all fairly much taught the same thing at the same time. John Fiennes of the Historical Association, he was the guy. What he said is that it would destroy brilliant history teaching, but it would improve the generality. Mm-hmm. And I think, looking back, he's turned out to be absolutely correcting that. Personally, I didn't have any problem with it at all, because I don't think it matters what you teach. The content, some of it's more interesting than others, but you can always find interesting bits. I hate the Stuarts, sort of with a vengeance, you can always find something interesting to do. So it didn't bother me, them telling me what I had to teach. And of course, the other thing is that I think one of the things they found about history teachers is that we are infinitely anarchic. And at the end of the day, they will say, we want you to teach the British Empire. And they have a very right-wing agenda when they want us to do that. And so if we all go away and teach the British Empire, and we teach the Amritsar massacre, and there are ways and means of subverting the intentions of those who have power. And I think we're very good at this, and it didn't bother me at all. I enjoyed teaching the national curriculum, and I enjoyed writing the textbooks for it.
So would you have preferred there to have been no revisions, because you were saying earlier there are too many revisions? You would have been happy to stick with what was put in place in 1990 just go forward with that?
I don't think it matters. I mean, the revisions were utterly irrelevant to me because all the revisions that were done with the ability to just carry on doing what you did if you were happy with what you did anyway. And sort of the revisions were just fiddling at the edges, I thought. Sort of giving you a little bit more freedom here. The current national curriculum basically gives you the freedom to do anything you want, whenever you want it to do, which I think makes it pointless in having a national curriculum. Might as well just say, well, we abolish it. But actually, from everything I know, there's many teachers just going on teaching what they set up in 1990 anyway, and life goes on. And sort of recently a guy went on the History Teachers Forum and said, can I do the Romans in year 9? And it was quite interesting, this sort of the reaction of, ooh, ooh, ooh. Ooh, be careful. Don't just do it because you want to do it. You've got to have a reason to do it, and sort of all the materials are wrong. And it was quite funny, people's reactions.
So they're quite conservative, really.
In a strange kind of way, yes.
The other thing is, of course, whether chronology has been restored by the national curriculum.
I have a beef about chronology. I don't think chronology exists. I think it's a nonsense. People talk about the skill of chronology, and it's an absolute nonsense. I think the first thing you have to understand is that teaching things in chronological order does not teach children chronology. Anybody who's had a child knows that a child's chronology goes, me, my sister, mum lived in the olden days, granddad was just after Jesus, and the dinosaurs. I mean, sort of, and people say, oh no, we need to teach them the skill of chronology. And then you say to, the question I always ask is this, put these in chronological order. Mayan pre-Columbian civilization, the Kingdom of Benin, Han China. Put those in chronological order. Are you unable to do so? You have no chronology skills. And sort of chronology is not a function, is not a skill. Chronology is merely a function of learning. And it's part of this whole arrogance of these people who roll up and ask questions to which they are delighted that the children can't. Did you know I asked the children about evacuation during World War II and they didn't know where they went? Outrageous. And sort of, well, no, because we just didn't teach them that bit. And sort of, you very cleverly found something that a 14-year-old didn't know. How clever of you. If I'd have taught the child that, they would have known it. But then they wouldn't have known something else that I didn't teach them. Sort of, and we have all these people who sort of roll up and are outraged because the children don't know how to do that anymore.
Do you think that's partly because there's just so much history worth knowing nowadays, as opposed to what was considered worth knowing in the past?
No, I don't think things have changed. Basically, you have 80 hours. And that's if you get 2 hours a week. You have 40 hours minus first lesson of the term, last lesson of the term, sports days, if you have 1 hour a week in a year. And sort of, what you can teach children is exceptionally limited. And when Colin Rutherford gave me those exercise books and said, make sure they know that, I went away and made sure that they knew that. They knew nothing. Out with those exercise books. Nothing at all. And what is it different with my children now who know what I've taught them but don't know some of the things that were in those exercise books? And it just really doesn't bother me at all. And sort of particularly with history, this is why I always believe, I don't think it really matters what you learn at all. It's whether you enjoyed it and whether you've got a will to go and carry on and find out more about it when you get older, and whether you're equipped with some of those skills of discernment which allow you not to just believe what you read in the Daily Mail and the history that's dished up by to you by the Daily Mail. And sort of, and these are the things I think, which we ought to be teaching them first. I think that the Key Stage 4 curriculum is hugely overcrowded. Far too. They've shoved so much more into Key Stage 4.
GCSE.
That it is impossible to address any of it in any depth whatsoever. And so the children, particularly, I've got whole beefs about this later on, which I'll share with you. We're trying to teach them far too much. We do much better to teach them much less, and then let them learn in the rest of their life about all those great bits of history, which we didn't manage to teach them about. And I don't think it matters what you teach them.
That sort of addresses the next question about whether it's important for history in school to promote a sense of national identity. Do you think it is or not?
Now, here, I get so angry about this, and you are. I do apologise for my reaction. In 2009, 1 in 9 of the people living in Britain, and 1 in 3 of the people living in London, was born abroad. 1 in 7 primary school pupils did not speak English at home. Now, suddenly, we are dealing with people here who don't even understand national identity in terms of Britishness. When John Major was asked what he thought about national identity, he said, "Oh, it's the thwack of leather on willow and Miss Marple cycling." I mean, he goes back some 1930s England. And sort of what I think we have to, I'm quite happy to promote a national identity as long as the national identity which we are trying to promote is a realistic multicultural identity which actually mirrors the experiences of the children in my classroom. Now up here we're 97% white English, but I'm talking that I see it as my job to try and make them aware of a different national identity which isn't all white and all English. And I just think that isn't in the minds of many of the people who want us to teach national identity. Many of the people who want us to teach national identity have a hidden agenda that they want to teach Englishness, which they see as being under siege from an influx of immigrants. And I think they see Englishness as something which is dying, and they want to use history to protect it, to get across a certain political agenda with the children. And if that is the thing, then I instinctively revolt against that. That is not my job as a teacher.
But if you were building a new identity, what history is most suitable to do that?
I think that, you're asking the next question, don't you? I think this is where the choice of the classroom teacher is the sensitive choice of the classroom teacher is absolutely paramount, isn't it? To be able to understand what your children need in order to interest them in history and to develop their sense of belonging. I think it's important that children have a sense of belonging. I would be very happy to build on that idea. I'm not interested in going back to sort of 1920s America, where we have classes to Americanize the immigrants. That is unacceptable. I'm just aware that history can be so easily politicized, and as long as that's left out of question number 13, then I do see a role for it, and in fact address it in this textbook.
Address the issue of British
teaching
identity.
Britishness, yes. Sort of images of Britishness, what is Britishness? and there's the sort of that's the thing, and there's some facts here about it all. And this book was written precisely to look at our changing reactions to it.
That
I mean, this isn't really why I got the book out, but sort of that's actually what this one particularly tries to do.
A Nation of Immigrants, published this year. I was going to ask you about that book actually, because it does address a very politically sensitive subject, immigration. Do you think that's appropriate in the subject of history, as opposed to, say, citizenship or even religious education?
You see, these are selling appallingly, but actually they're some of the best books I've ever written, and Hodder really went out on a limb and got their fingers burned. I'm so sorry to Hodder. And what they did is they allowed me to address some really hot potatoes through the medium of history. And do you not think that history is the very, very medium to be able to do that? This is around in RE, and they talk off the top of their heads. But to be able to talk about issues such as this, having a historical grounding of you know, the fact that basically the Saxons and Vikings were immigrants of a certain kind. Certainly the Middle Ages, we were lots of different immigrant groups moved in, and then you study the Windrush period and times that, and then out of that you look at what's happening now, and you're able to come out with something which hopefully is not just a sort of a raging prejudice. And I think that sort of golly knows whether I've done it properly or not, but I've tried to do it in a responsible manner which allows children to come out at the end of it with the opportunity to have formed some sensitive, sensible conclusions based on facts and based on the history.
This book, A Nation of Immigrants, is for Key Stage 4, is it?
Key Stage 3, aimed at year 9.
Year 9s. Is that the time when you would normally address that topic?
Well, you see, the thing is you're in Key Stage 4, you're trapped with the GCSE syllabus, aren't you? So your best chance for anything like that, and you mentioned the Holocaust in the next one, I think is Year 9.
I wanted to ask you actually about that, because you're implying that there is a moral purpose behind the content or the teaching of history, particular history. And of course, the only mandatory topics in Key Stage 3 are the Holocaust and the slave trade in the context of the British Empire. Do you think those have been mandated because of this moral dimension?
I can't tell you why, because I didn't do it, did I?
No, but your opinion as a history teacher, why do you think those topics are of such importance that every child has to learn them?
I think that the slave trade, given the multicultural nature of Britain today, I think it is absolutely essential that we as sentient human beings should address this issue, because I think it raises so many issues about how we relate to each other today, how we came to be where we are in our relevant, and I think it's desperately important for black British children to know about it and to know what went on. And in the book I wrote on the slave trade, because there's one in this series on the slave trade, to address the issue that a lot of the so-called sort of horrors are made up. They didn't happen, you know. Sort of the desperate over-egging of the pudding in terms of what went on a slave ship, and to come to terms with that. And I think it's desperately important also for white British children to realise what their ancestors got up to and why Britain turned out to be the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world, and on what it was based, and that it wasn't based on some kind of innate superiority here. And the so I think it's a tremendously important subject. In terms of the Holocaust, I personally believe the Holocaust has been and is taught absolutely wrongly in many, many schools, and increasingly of that opinion. But in a world where we are so in danger of sinking into racism and hatred based on religion, I think it's terribly important that we should study this, particularly not actually the event and what happened, but its development out of what was regarded at the time as a very normal and cultured society. It benefits study by us as a society. There's a phrase, isn't there, "There but for the grace of God go I."
Mm.
And so I'm tremendously supportive of both those topics.
Why do you think it's taught badly?
Because in most schools, if you go and talk to most of your teachers, what you will find is they teach and they probably do the slave trade in the same way. Wasn't this outrageous kind of way? Look at this scummy behaviour kind of teaching. And what they do is they just teach the atrocities, as though teaching the atrocities was a lesson in itself. And my view of this in the terms of the Holocaust is that in teaching the atrocities only, we hand the Nazis the victory all over again. And yes, we rather tut and don't think it was very nice, but nevertheless we present the Jews as people to whom stuff was done and who just stood there and let it happen. And we really teach them as faceless non-people upon whom these dreadful things were enacted by these very powerful, white, fair-haired guys who were clearly superior. And in the end, they lost, didn't they? Millions of them died, and we had to come in and stop it. And I think we need... in the teaching of the Holocaust, a much more an approach which takes account of the individual reactions of individuals and groups of Jewish people in the specific circumstances in which they found themselves. And so unfortunately, if you think now, there's a whole load of things coming out which in fact are beginning to try to redress that balance. Films like Defiance, which are beginning to show Jews hiding in the woods and fighting back, and things like that. But I don't think we're anywhere near that. I'm a bit disappointed about the teaching of the Holocaust, mainly because I think it fails in its moral dimension. Makes a liar of me, of course, this whole thing, because I've been saying that I reject any kind of political agenda which tries to make me, and I'm saying that these things are important because we're a multicultural society. I shall hold those two things in tension.
Do you want a break?
I can do if you want to. So,
are you happy?
I'm happy.
Right. Do you think exams in history have changed for the better over time?
When I started teaching history, as I said earlier, what happened was that the children learned chunks of history. They went the same subjects, the same questions came up every year. You put 3 from 20 and you just regurgitated it. Then there was this period in the middle of my teaching career where children... I thought history was the hardest subject of all, because what children had to do is there were a whole set of questions on unseen materials that they couldn't really... know what was coming up, and yet they still had to learn this huge corpus of facts of history in order to be able to apply those to skills. It was skills and facts and unseen questions, and I thought, these children are just remarkable. Now, of course, what's happened is that over the last few years, history boards have been saying, oh, well, we'll help you by asking the same questions all the time. The question will be in the same form. You know, it'll be on a different topic, but don't worry. The wording will always be this. And sort of this added to this priority of bringing home the points, which is the death of education, I think, has meant, I think, that there's a terrible temptation, particularly in certain state schools where the children might find themselves less culturally privileged. I think the thing is the danger is that you say, you basically teach, when you have this question, do this. Answer it in this way. Jump through these hoops, A, B, C, D, and sort of, and I think it's been the death of GCSE history teaching in many, many schools, because the teacher just churns the handle. The children learn, oh, I've got to do this and this and this and this and this. And really, they're not actually learning the skills that they want to do. What they're doing, they're learning the skill of passing an exam question, not the actual skill that they were meant to be doing. I'm terribly hostile to exams today.
Sounds a bit like the old O-level.
It is, yes. The same question comes up every time, and we'll prepare you for this and you can jump through that.
Mm-hmm. So what changes would you like to see?
I think that, I mean, this ties in with the question you're going to ask in a moment, or I sort of will now probably jump to, which is history in danger? And I think in sort of less culturally advantaged state schools, it's in terrible danger at the moment, because it's a single award, it's a difficult subject, it doesn't bring home many points. It's one of those subjects in which, in a school like mine, where basically the children don't know what a communist is, and they don't know what the Urals are, and talk about Trans-Siberian Railway, you have to tell them what Siberia is. They do not possess a kind of a background, a cultural background, which allows them to analyse things. You tell me to teach everything, it doesn't. These are the history of the subject in which they underperform in their CVA. And in a world where CVA and point scores are absolutely everything, and where this is top down now, people are telling the school what results they've got to get, and the senior management team are going away and saying, well, to get those results, the children have got to get those results. You must get that from your teacher. That's the way education goes at the moment in 2010. History is an unwanted subject because it doesn't bring home the bacon. And so you're finding history is being sliced back in a whole raft of state schools because it's not supplying the points. And sort of the subjects that are being advanced in those schools are subjects like BTEC PE. And there's a whole set of qualifications coming in which offer a level two, but where it's not based on what you know, and it's not evaluated hierarchically on an A to G. It's basically, have you done it? If you've done it, then you achieve this level. And there's a corpus of work, a body of work that you have to do, and if you've done it, then you've done it. And sort of, and they, BTECs, bring home four GCSEs. So a teacher, you know, you've got many schools where they're cutting history in order to put the turn the children on to subjects like PE.
Is that happening in your school?
You know, in my school, I'm proud to say that they can't do it because the children love history so much that they choose it, and their parents come in and say, yes, we know it doesn't get as good a result, but my son wants to do it. And sort of, so they choose it knowingly, but I can't tell you that SMT are very pleased about it. And it's sort of, they'd much rather they do BTEC acting, which is, again, that sort of, yeah, lots of good points for doing that. And one of the big problems with history is that there is no viable level one course, and there is no viable BTEC, and sort of, I know they're trying to bring in a humanities diploma, but that's only aimed at the most able pupils. And there is sort of no subject that a head of department in school like mine can, no course that they can say, but that I can bring home the bacon in that course. And it would be so easy to devise. And that is what we need more than anything else.
It would be the Mode 3 CSE, something like.
I think anybody who heard that would remind you that Mode 3 CSE was the most abused qualification of all time and was absolutely meaningless. It would have to be meaningful. We do need a qualification in at that. And the other thing we need, of course, desperately, is we need foundation and higher tier levels as well, so that you can actually, sort of the concept of a one exam fits all is really crazy, particularly in a subject like history. And that is why you're having a situation where in your culturally advantaged state schools, they're saying this subject is worthless. The children can pass it in year 8, year 9, sort of because it asks the same questions in the same way. All they do is churn out the handler. They can just do it like this. It's easy peasy. We're not bothering with history because it's a worthless subject. And sort of in schools like mine, you've got children in year 11 who just do not know how to get their heads around these ideas because they don't possess the cultural grounding to be able to address the subject conceptually or academically.
Do you not think that was always the case? What's changed to make this more pointed as an issue now?
I think the numbers of children taking GCSEs is collapsing, really, isn't it? Certainly AQA. Having dire times, there's sort of, and I think that government pressure, and a world in which we've got to concentrate on design and innovation as well. I think it's sort of, I think we go back to Mel French. We have to. I don't think it's the children you need to convince. They quite enjoy doing history and just love it anyway. I think it's the powers that be who need convincing that history has a viable and important place, and sort of must be given the elbow room, given the room to actually perform.
Just coming on to technology, that's played an important part in your. The dissemination of ideas, and how has that had impacted on your teaching over the years?
I was developing computer programs, writing them for the BBC when TVI was in, and it was all part of that skills and fun. And I wrote a lot of exciting games. And your last question, which we're not going to actually ask, was what would be the one lesson I would do? It would be my 1066 computer game, which counted down in real time as you played either Hardrada or Godwinson or William, and you manoeuvred and waited along and you got your things together. Eventually you went and had a war and lost and won, and it was a very, very exciting lesson. The computer gave all kinds of... I can remember writing a thing called the Data 100, which was 100 sources which you could quiz. You can still buy it. Somebody's bought it and they still sell it. And in those days, there was all these kinds of dreams of about what a computer-based curriculum could deliver.
When are we talking about?
80s.
Yeah.
80s. But it got so expensive and it required so much time. And sort of then we moved to this kind of idea of not specific technology, but generic technology, and using the using Word and using Excel as part of your teaching, and sort of the 90s and into the noughties, it was all about... generic technology, and still is, you know, because it's basically now you use your overhead whiteboard as a teaching tool and not so much as a learning tool, sort of. So I do know large numbers of teachers take their children into a classroom and just shove them on the website and say, research this, do this. And there are simple exercises on there that the children can do. But I think it's a step back on the kind of stuff we were doing in the 1980s, funny enough, which was real kind of trailblazing. Using the abilities of the computer to find new ways of learning new things. I don't think I've got anything much more to say there.
How do you feel your own website contributes to students' learning?
The key word here that I thought was elective. And what the website was that I wrote a series just off the cuff and tried to persuade a publisher to publish it, and they weren't interested. So in a huff, I just put it on the web and said, right, I'll let everybody have it then. And since then, I've maintained it as a kind of a thank you to people for buying the books. It's jolly decent of them. But I think that this is perhaps the greatest revolution in learning. Because when I was doing A-level, for instance, occasionally I would go down to the library and see three or four books, which I had to try and get through in the evening. I had a textbook, which I used to learn from, and that was it, wasn't it? Now, what a wealth of material you have at the touch of a button. And I think the opportunities simply in the availability of materials make the chance to create proper historians out of our more academic children, and I think what my website tries to do is to structure this in a way which helps them through the process of getting the basics, developing the idea, addressing some of the sources and things like that. And of course the other thing is the History Help Forum, where children write in with their questions and we answer them as best we can. I mean,
have you got somebody else working with you on it?
Well, it's not mine, it's run by a guy called Andrew Field, and I just answer most of the questions. And there are a team of teachers who are supposed, use the word supposed, to work on that. It tends to be mainly me. And I think this sort of accessibility, and if you're a pupil now, you can get at 100 times more than I ever could. You have opportunities to do it, but you have to want to do it.
That's great.
Right, I'll shut
Thanks up. Very much.